Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrne, a potpourri of podcasts by me, veterinary ethologist Myrne Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed.
Who studies feline social intelligence? I thought about this when I read an article with the headline, "Cats Rival Dogs on Many Tests of Social Smarts," but is anyone brave enough to study them? But before I could answer that editorial question, I needed to know the origin and meaning of the phrase social intelligence. An online search revealed that the term was coined by American psychologist Edward Thorndike back in the 1920s. He defined it as a person's ability to understand and manage people of all ages and act wisely in human relationships. He believed people develop social intelligence by interacting with other people. Over time, other human behavioral scientists broadened the term to refer to one person's ability to relate to other people in all ways. Logic suggests that comparable studies involving members of other species would explore an animal's ability to do likewise with members of their own species. And indeed, numerous ethology studies do exactly that. However, the feline social intelligence studies described in this article are interspecific. They evaluate the ability of the study animals to communicate effectively with people. That is, to respond the way specific people or dogs would under similar circumstances. And that, as we say in the trade, is a completely different kettle of cat food. So going back to the headline's question, is anyone brave enough to study cats? The answer is pretty simple. Yes, there are lots of people brave enough to study cats. This includes just about everyone who's lived with a cat and whether they want to or not. It's a survival thing. We study how they interact with us and everyone and everything in their surroundings because we must. Because sometimes the way cats behave is so alien from ours under those same circumstances, we feel obligated to try to understand it. But at other times, their behaviors are so similar to our own, it's embarrassing, and sometimes downright creepy, as if they knew more about us than we did. It's no surprise that some people can handle such behavioral diversity, while others cannot. Sometimes those conducting behavioral studies or those reading them begin with a faulty premise, that cats are solitary and dogs are social, like us. But like members of all domestic species, cats may be social, solitary, and anything and everything between. Which approach they take depends on what gets them the maximum amount of physiological and behavioral stability using the least amount of energy in that environment, just like dogs and us. This can create challenges for us when we want to add another cat to our households. A cat from the solitary end of the feline sociability spectrum may hate the sight of all other cats, or cats plus any human or other animal they perceive as a predator or competitor for some reason. At the social end, are those cats whose amazing social intelligence and related skills enable them to survive and thrive together, sometimes in large numbers, within a relatively small amount of space. And in the middle of the spectrum, we have everybody else. Consequently, adding a cat to a household already claimed by one or more cats can be an iffy proposition. And the less we know about the involved cat's origins, the iffier it may be. There's a whole body of literature dedicated to devices, techniques, drugs, and perhaps even a magical potion or two that supposedly will convince any resident cats to accept any newcomers and vice versa. In general, the odds for success seem to be about 50-50. Resident and new cats either will or they won't accept each other. And their perception of the home's physical and emotional environment almost invariably will trump any images of any instant multi-cat bliss we may entertain. For example, in my previous lives, I've lived with multiple cats trouble-free in an urban apartment, two suburban homes, and a brand new home in the country. All of these places were roughly the same small size. But as I learned from some sad experiences, this little old house on the hill is a one-cat household. What is it about my current homestead that made and makes it a one-town cat? Rodents. Specifically, a limited indoor and outdoor supply of them. And a human who prefers natural feline rodent control over poisons. Regarding that limited outdoor rodent supply, for sure there are plenty of rodents in the woods and meadows around the house. But there also are feline predators whose fear of humans keeps them away from the area immediately surrounding my home. Thus, their interspecies social intelligence leads successful companion cats in this setting also to limit their outdoor territories to those that support a rodent population just big enough for one cat. It also results in a subspecies of Felis catus some of my friends refer to as invisible cats because they rarely saw them. In addition to having the stealth and mackerel tabby coloration that enabled these cats to literally melt into the shadows of a dimly lit room or underbrush, like most good rodent hunters, they were more active after sunset and before sunrise. After that, they weren't inclined to interrupt their daytime sleep to fraternize with mere humans. But lest you label these cats solitary or, God forbid, antisocial, their intolerance of others only applied to other cats who entered the house or the resident feline-designated rodent-hunting preserve immediately around it. And despite the invisible title bestowed on them by human visitors, feline invisibility indoors didn't necessarily mean the cat wasn't there or was unaware of their presence. It simply meant that the people lacked the perception to recognize when the cat was there. Often after the visitor departed, these cats would appear from beneath the couch or chair where the visitor sat. Depending on their mood, some might materialize behind me as I said my farewells to any visitors at the door. A few would sit on the doorstep and observe the visitors as they drove down the driveway. Although a few sensitive guests were miffed by what they considered a feline snub, I perceived this as more feline-human social data collection. I say this because the highest accolade these cats could bestow was to seemingly materialize, walk up to a select few visitors, solicit an ear rub, and then purr ecstatically when the person complied. An invisible cat experience that makes you feel like you've been chosen. Or even blessed. Even if you've thought nasty thoughts about the cat who refused your companionship for all those years, or even hated cats. Whatever else this variation on the feline social intelligence theme may be, it's not antisocial behavior. All of the highly feline, solitary, residential, rodent-killing cats who have lived in the little house on the hill got along with the resident dog population, plus the occasional canary and fish in a 50-gallon aquarium. What makes these and other interspecies relationships work is an awareness that we sometimes forget when we judge feline responses according to some fixed human criteria. Just because cats may not respond the way we want or expect them to, doesn't mean they lack social intelligence. The only way that would be true is if we chose to define it that way.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Catova Arts, www.catova.com.